CliffCentral.com. I am very happy to talk to Justin Cohen this morning. He has just written a book called Pitch to Win, the internationally acclaimed six-step formula. Now, who doesn't need to know how to present, persuade, and close the deal? This sounds like a Donald Trump-style book. I'm going to teach you how to close the deal. Look at you, Justin Cohen. How are you, man?
Good to be with you, G.
It's nice to see you.
Yeah.
So, dude, first things first, let me just remind people, because it has been a little while since we've had you on the show. You have been a leading authority for the longest time on human potential. Honors degree in psychology. You speak and train in fields of motivation, sales, service, and leadership. You've hosted a TV talk show in which you interviewed some of the world's top experts on success. You've also got the CNBC Africa show, which is still going. You've got a certified speaker professional and South African Speaker Hall of Fame inductee award behind your name. And you've spoken and trained in over 20 countries to Fortune 500 companies, including Microsoft, Virgin, Barclays, BMW, EY, Walmart, HSBC, Mercedes-Benz, and Duke. You can go to justinpresents.com to find out more. Wow. There's a lot going on. And you're not even old.
I can't wait to hear what I have to say.
Hell of an intro. You know, sometimes when people say too much about you, it almost like it promises so much. And then when you hear them, you're like, You know when you go to these presentations and people say, and here he is, the world acclaimed. And you're like, oh, shit, don't put me under pressure.
Yeah, but at least with you, Gareth, you know, you rise to it.
Congrats on this book. I didn't realize you've written four books and you've got seven audiobooks.
Well, it's actually the fifth book, I had to say. Actually, that was you underplaying me. You were like, no, it's actually four, so that I feel like now I can rise up and say
it's fine.
I kind of became addicted to writing books. I really do. I absolutely love it. A lot of people don't write their own books. No. They ghosted and stuff. In fact, this December, I'm so excited. I am staying in Johannesburg to write my book. I'm writing my book in, we're better to be in Joburg than in summer and December.
I couldn't agree more.
Just love it. And I mean, I had some options and I was like, oh, I can go to Goa in India and I can do this. And I thought, what do you really want to do? I want to stay home and write a book. But what happened with this book, I actually stopped writing books. I decided I would not write another book until I figured out how to sell books. Because selling books and writing books are very different skill sets.
People don't make money out of books very easily.
They don't, and that's okay. One doesn't really expect to make money, but at least you want to sell them and get enough sort of traction out there to then do the other things, which is obviously build profile, you do the speaking and training, which is really the engine of my business.
All right, so let's start off with why you decided to write this one and who it's aimed at and what this whole idea of human potential. Do you think everybody has the ability to present, persuade, to sell?
I think everybody with a average intelligence has the potential to do way more things than they think. And I can tell you that pitching.
So what stops us?
What stops us is a lot of it's belief. You know, if you don't believe you can do something. I mean, one of the most important things, this is something I talk about in the book, is that there's two kinds of mindsets, and this is really well researched. And I'm kind of big. I know there's a lot of fluff in self-help. There's really a lot of fluff. There's a lot of opinion. There's a lot of, you know. I'm really big into research. And I'm not saying that you can't question some research, because research, you know, we can also be skeptical about. But I just want to be clear that this is not just my opinion. There's a solid base of research. Carol Dweck from Stanford University, that we got two kinds of mindsets. The one is a growth mindset, and the other is a fixed mindset. Now, fixed mindset says you're born great or you're not. And I really believe that I was not born great. I struggled at school. It was tough for me. And I really had this perception of myself that, you know, I wasn't very smart. And, you know, maybe actually genetically I wasn't that smart. But with a growth mindset, you don't actually have to be very smart. What you have to do is believe that, in fact, ability is something you acquire through hard work, through reading, self-development, and if you have that belief, just think about it. If you believe that you're born, in fact, there's a lovely specific study on languages. If you know, people say, I'm not good at languages. That I'm not good at languages almost guarantees that you will really struggle and be unable to learn a language.
That's a very interesting point. I spoke just the other day at this media and marketing mobile conference or whatever it was, and I reiterated to these people something I've always believed, and I think it's hugely important. You say something, it creates consequence. Is this where you're going with this idea, or am I on a tangent?
Well, certainly what you say to yourself has a consequence.
Yes.
Absolutely.
If you tell yourself you're good at something, you will be better at it.
And not so much that you're good at it. And in fact, here's the interesting thing. If you tell a kid you're really clever, how's this? You actually reduce their IQ.
What?
Yes. I'll tell you why you do that. Because the kid then goes, I'm clever. Ooh, I like the idea of myself being clever. So when the kid then gets a challenging task, they go, ooh, I don't want to now seem not so clever. So they avoid doing the task. The anxiety rises and they're actually less able to achieve it. So instead of telling the kid they're clever, what you want to do is tell the kid.
Fucking stupid.
Well, no, you don't want to do that. That's what I was told, by the way. And literally, I'm not even kidding.
You were told by your...
Absolutely. I was
who,
told
your parents?
School. I mean, I was told...
Justin, you're a moron.
Retard.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're retard.
Los Cop was my nickname at school. And so that became
did you call you a retard?
Yeah. Look, I mean, listen, Gareth. I mean, I'm a little older than you. We didn't go to school in the most enlightened time.
Dude, hang on a second. I want to just... Pause on that for a minute, because a lot of millennials go, oh, life is so hard for us now. You were called retard by your teacher.
No, I mean, it was actually kind of worse than that. I mean, I was on the, because I wasn't very good at sports. My hand coordination really leaves much to be desired.
What were you good at?
I wasn't good at much, Gareth. That's why I say you've got to have a growth mindset. I wasn't born great.
Okay.
You know, I'm not saying I'm great now, but I've acquired a few skills.
This is IQ thing. So you actually ruin a child's chances if you're very mean to them or if you're too nice to them.
No, let's just be clear. Okay. It's how you compliment them. Okay. And again, this is Carol Dweck, Stanford. There's a solid base of research on this. If you tell a kid you are smart, you are intelligent, they don't want to prove that they're not, so they resist doing challenging tasks. They're more likely to cheat, by the way, as well, because they want to prove, oh no, I'm smart. So instead, you say to a kid, you don't say you're so smart. You say, wow, you work really hard. You know, when the going gets tough, you bounce back and try again, you know.
Yes.
When you fail, you learn the lesson and get up, and so you're priming them to say it's okay to fail, it's okay to fall down, as long as you work hard and keep trying that. And then they go, hey, there's a challenging task. They say, I'm going to really get stuck into this because, you know, this is the way that, you know, that I'm appreciated. You see, what gets appreciated gets repeated.
Yes.
What gets appreciated gets repeated. So if you appreciate me for something that's fixed, like being smart, well, then I just got to keep pretending that I'm smart, you know. So
yeah, it's almost like you've achieved it already. There's no more reward.
Exactly.
But if you do every task and get praise for every task as a child, and especially praise from your parents and acceptance, you want to keep doing it.
Exactly. And, you know, Gareth, you must be familiar with the research. It was popularized in Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Outliers.
Yes.
It's Anders Ericsson, Florida State University, spent 10 years studying top individual sport, business, arts, science. And he came up with a 10,000-hour rule, that innate factors.
Which
were
has become
not
like a religion for some people.
It's become
people who are actually keeping tabs on their hours.
Yeah, which is a bit of a problem because there's a big caveat with that. It's not just 10,000 hours. It's not just kind of, you know, knocking your head away. That's not what it's about. It's actually very specific, those 10,000 hours. I mean, you do 10,000 hours in the wrong way and you'll be worse than you were before. It's with feedback. It's with preferably some sort of coaching. It's with continual improvements. That's really important. But I'll tell you what I find astonishing, and I don't know if Gladwell, don't think Gladwell actually brings this up. There's a lovely a point about certain things do require some innate ability or innate physiological state, like basketball.
Yeah.
So you think, like, well, I mean, come on, spend, you know, somebody who's not a little height challenged is not going to be great basketball no matter how many hours they spend.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great, and I'm not a, you know, I'm not, I don't follow sport very much, but there's a legend in basketball, a guy called Spud Webb. Spud Webb at 5 foot 6, if I'm not mistaken. Definitely he wasn't anywhere near 6 foot. I became a slam dunk champion.
Really?
Yeah, slam dunk champion in basketball. He put in his more than his 10,000 hours, you know. So I just love that as a, you know, just a, you know, even where I thought, okay, come on, you're not going to be a great basketball player.
No, sure.
But clearly, you know, they are, when you really do put in that time, and that's why you've got to be passionate about what you do. I mean, think about what you do. Gee, I mean, you are doing this every day. You know, you're talking to people and refining ideas, and I mean, that just unconsciously you're just gonna, you know, you're just gonna develop that skill. It's incredible, and unfortunately, many people who are passionate about something don't get the opportunity to do enough of it, and that's why you've got to just do it, even when you're not getting paid for it. You know, you've got to.
That's for some people that's very hard, because. Yeah. They've got real-world bills to pay and all that stuff, and they want to spend their 10,000 or more hours learning to play the violin and learning to play it really well, but they don't have the time.
Well, I don't know. I find that a bit of a wussy.
You think that's an excuse?
When people tell me they don't have time, I'm like, look, if you've got 4 kids and you've got 12, you know, dependents, and I don't want to be unsympathetic. I kind of feel like I have to put up my hand here and say, look, I have a very, you know, I have a lot of time. So I know it is
easier for me. Well, you've managed your time to be like that.
I've also chosen this life. You know, I've chosen not to have children. I've chosen not to, you know, have those kinds of demands on my time.
You selfish bastard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I do think this thing, I don't have time. You know, what I would say is whatever, and I get, you know, excuses. Look, one thing, we've got to take responsibility here. And whenever you come up with a reason why you can't, you give yourself what I call a why can't story. Henry Ford, you think you can, you think you can't, you're always right. You know, if you say, I can't because I've got no time, you're not even going to try. Before you get out, you know, it's done, it's over for you. And what I always say to people, because in my audiences, when we do, I do a lot of work on this, when we look, it's one of the keys to success, by the way, internal locus of control, that no matter what's happening, you're going to say, you know, okay, what can I do to make this happen?
No, but people, listen, South Africans, we've got an A in complaining. We love to complain. And we don't only complain, we blame everyone but ourselves when anything goes wrong. The potholes on the road, the government, the crime, the government. The corruption, the government.
Well,
Everything's outside. We have no control. The Guptas came in here and they just ripped us off blind. They stole all of our money. Well, they saw a bunch of sitting ducks.
Yeah. So I
take some responsibility.
Absolutely. And you know, the big one in South Africa. And here's the thing. Whenever you blame something you have no control over, like, I can't because I'm too young, because I'm too old, because I'm male, because I'm female. What's the big one in South Africa today?
Race.
I'm a white male. Oh, I can't because I'm a white male. Yeah. Do you know what the unemployment rates for white people are in this country?
No.
6.5-7%. 6.5-7%. 28% for black people, but I can't because I'm a white male. Now, let me be clear. There are certain jobs where it would be better if you were white or black. And clearly in South Africa, you know, yes, absolutely.
If you're trying to be Minister of Home Affairs, it's not going to happen for you if you're a white guy.
Yeah. But by the way, there's still like one or two white cabinet ministers. So, I mean, it's not like you can't become a cabinet minister.
You could be a cabinet minister, sure.
But when you blame something that you can't control, and this is what I love, and I think we're allowed a little bit expletive on your show. You can beat this one.
Go on.
The only thing stopping you from getting what you want is your bullshit story about why you can't get it. And whenever you're blaming something you can't control, that's a bullshit story, and I'll tell you why. Because whatever you want to achieve, when you tell me you can't because, there is somebody with that same condition who is achieving more than you.
Yes.
So there's somebody who's already doing it, okay? So if you say, I can't, then you know. It's a BS story. Somebody's already doing it. Now, I'm not saying that there's somebody in the same conditions who's doing less than you. There probably is too. So well done. You're doing pretty well, but you can do better.
That's human potential in a sentence.
Exactly.
This is what got you, and it gets you so fired up, which is what I love. Justin and I never used to like each other.
It's true.
He came in here begrudgingly, said, yeah, I'll come and do an interview with this prick. And I said, I don't want to talk to this motivation dude. Because that's what I thought. I thought you were one of those, you know, yes, yes, yes guys.
Yeah, look at this.
And we started talking, and then I discovered, no, this guy's smart. He's interesting. He really cares. He's passionate about the subject. He's helped a lot of people. You have. This is why people come to you.
You know, there is a lot of bullshit in the motivational personal development field. I mean, we could have a, and one of the things that I, you know, and I'm glad that you and I don't know if we can quite call each other friends, but I think we're getting there. And by the way, I really am grateful for that because I really value your look at our little mutual congratulations club. I really value your smarts and your intelligence and your willingness to say things. I think in the time when you and I kind of crossed a little bit, I felt that, you know, sometimes I struggled with some of the things that you said because I'm kind of played a little bit nicer than you do.
Yeah.
But what I do value is that you will say things. I'm not saying I agree with everything that you say, but you will say things that in the world today, there's not a lot of courage about saying, putting things out there that maybe don't fit, you know, the way that we should say things. And by the way, I believe in political correctness, but I know that it can go really overboard and it can lead to really not acknowledging reality, you know.
Well, this is what I want to ask you this morning, and I'm just jamming this into the conversation because I know it's going to come up, and you must have discussed it a million times. As a psychologist, as someone who's interested in human behavior and human potential, I need to understand how you do Donald Trump, how you figure him out, because this guy, there's so many words. We've got these amateur shrinks all over the place who are saying he's a narcissist, he's an egomaniac, he is all those things. That's patently obvious. You're not giving me any revelation. But you watch humans, you watch the way they behave, their body language, their attitude to others. Just last night, he told Jim Acosta from CNN, you're a very sad, hard, very terrible person. Those were the words he used. You're a terrible person. And I watched this and I thought, you know what? I need a psychologist to decode this man for me.
Look, I'm so glad you asked because I love American politics. I follow it diligently. For me, it's the greatest soap opera in the world. And sometimes it's quite a relief to know that I'm not an American and I don't live there and I don't actually have to deal with what's going on because it's just kind of so outrageous. So Donald Trump's very interesting. And in fact, maybe we can watch the author bring it back to his book. But there's one of the keys to a winning pitch. Donald Trump is one of the greatest pitchmen in the world.
Every
4 years, the biggest pitch that happens on planet Earth is pitch for leader of the free world.
Yeah.
And pitchman Donald, he's won it. He won it. He won it fair and square. I do want to add, though, because I think this is very important for Trump supporters out there, that let's just be clear, the American system, I'm a big fan of America, big fan of Americans, but there is a major flaw in their system. Donald Trump... Hillary Clinton got nearly 3 million votes more than Donald Trump, right? It's because of the way the American system works that the states are given...
It's why it's a republic and not a democracy. People don't understand. The rules of the game are you have to win in the college. And unfortunately for Hillary, she doesn't understand game theory. And unfortunately for Hillary, Donald does. He seriously knows how to win.
He knows
that. And at all costs.
Although, Gareth, there's also, we're very good at making sense of black swans. And Donald Trump is a bit of a black swan. I mean, we weren't seeing this coming. This was something pretty extraordinary.
I took a bet with John Hunt from the ad agency TBWA a year before. I said to him, Trump's going to win. He said to me,
did you seriously?
I've got it on paper.
Kudos to you, brother. Because
proof.
I had a friend of mine. In fact, you've met Don Donovan.
I called Brexit.
Did you seriously? Well, that is phenomenal. Look, a stop clock is still right twice a day. But
thank you very much.
No. Look, that is seriously impressive. That is seriously impressive.
No, but you are right. Like, most people never would have expected this. In fact, all the polling up to the day before the election.
Totally.
Hillary's got this in the bag. So tell me about his personality. Okay, this is what I'm curious about.
So I want to get that in a moment, but I want to tell you one thing about why I think he won and how it applies to pitching, and that we all need to take a lesson out of Donald's book here, because here's for me what's so fascinating. You might recall Maya Angelou has said something to the effect of people don't remember what you say, they don't remember how you make them feel. Now, Roger Stone, if you think Donald Trump is a little unsavory, Roger Stone is...
Who is he?
I mean, he's... Well, Roger Stone was Trump's first campaign advisor, and he's currently under investigation as well, in the Mueller investigation. But he's a very, very smart Machiavellian character. Mm. And he said something that I think just brings home why Donald Trump won. And in fact, I've put out a little video, why Donald Trump won and what we can do to win our next pitch. So here it is. He puts it like this. People don't remember what you say. They remember how you say it. Now, according to the non-partisan fact checker, these guys check the amount of lies that politicians tell. And Donald Trump, I forget the exact figure, but it's hundreds before the election, and Hillary Clinton's was like 36. So they both lie, but like just Donald Trump exponentially more. I mean, the man really struggles to open his mouth without lying. Here's what I find fascinating. If you take Roger Stone's point there, I think what we can agree is that Hillary Clinton told the truth as if she was telling a lie. She was the classic diplomat, mincing her word, politically correct, etc. Donald Trump tells a lie as if he's telling the truth.
Yes. Yeah? Yeah, you're right.
It's like comes from the guts, man. He's your guy's guy, this macho dude who calls it like it is, no political correctness. And people are like, oh my gosh, he's so real, he's so authentic, he's so this. But he's lying. But he's telling it like no politician has ever told it with this absolute, because he...
Conviction.
Exactly.
Visceral.
Absolute conviction. So it's one
when
of the...
When he says to Jim Acosta, you are a terrible person.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, come on. How's...
He's selling it.
Tokyo, how's Jim Acosta a terrible person? I mean, he's a journo. He's just like, he's a wussy little journo. He's not actually, he's actually quite a courageous journo. But the point is, and that's the fifth key to a winning pitch. There's six keys. Notice the author bringing in his
yeah,
fifth
yeah,
key. And the fifth key is presence, which is over 50% of the impact of a communication is not what you say, it's how you say it. It's how you say it. And Gareth, I'll tell you something. One of the things, and I remember this when you came on air, how many years ago was it? Anyway, however long, I was like, this dude is different. I might not have
realized
it up front. I'll tell you what it is. It's exactly this point, and I've just realized. Most DJs, what do? They've got their DJ voice. Hey, it's 9 o'clock. Yeah. And by the way, I loved Alex J. I grew up with Alex J. But and Alex has actually got a very nice sort of real
nice
way.
Guy.
But Alex, it's that DJ voice, and it's quite deep, and it's like, hey, this is. You came on, and you were like, it's almost as if it was like some dude you were talking, having a coffee with, you know, you and I, you know, I've now had the privilege of knowing you off air. You're exactly the same. You've got the same tone in your voice. You've got the same. You don't put it on. There's no amplification of voice. It's just you are very, very real. And I think we're in an age now where, fortunately, this is what people want. They want authenticity. So I hate to say it, you and Donald Trump.
Oh, Jesus. That one sentence. But
you and Donald
Did you ever
Trump.
Think your life would come to this?
Look, the key difference is I believe that you tell the truth, whereas Donald doesn't. But it's this very real, authentic, real kind of...
But know. I like that thing that you said about Donald tells the lie as if it's the truth, and Hillary used to tell the truth as if it was a lie. Yeah. And people, there's something in us that is instinctively, it's almost maybe your reptile brain gets hijacked, or it hijacks the thinking part of the brain, and it says, this guy seems authentic, this guy seems like the real deal. But what kind of as a psychologist, I'm trying to get us into his head, winning at all costs is something that matters massively to this guy. He said it last night. He was talking about the election. I love to win. Winning is important. This I consider an almost complete victory. But this, you know, he has these things he throws in. What is this? What kind of a monster are we dealing with in terms of psychology?
Okay. Well, look, firstly, let me say I'm not a clinical psychologist.
No.
But look, Donald Trump, you don't have to be a clinical psychologist if you've done a few years of psych, he is a textbook narcissist. I know we talk about a lot of, oh, he's a narcissist. Everybody's ex-boyfriend is a narcissist. You know,
yeah.
But let's just be clear. Donald Trump, if you look at the DSM, you know, which is the catalog of mental disorders,
yes.
Donald Trump, I mean, and I'm not the first one to say this. There's the Association of Psychiatrists in the United States who are very concerned and have expressed their concern. And look, I also will say ethically, you can't do a diagnosis of someone just from their public pronouncements.
Yeah, you have to sit and talk to them, and he won't do that.
Everything. I mean, look, what is a narcissist? You are totally self-obsessed. I mean, there's a man who went to the CIA, was talking about fallen members of the CIA, and starts talking about how many people were at his came to his inauguration.
Yes.
I mean, he is absolutely.
He said the other day, I'm very good at judging crowd sizes.
I'm very good. Oh my gosh.
People don't know this about.
He's a very stable genius. I'm a very stable genius. What happened at the after these pipe bombs and, oh, that's right, the death at the synagogues.
They should have had more security.
He goes, but at his next campaign, what's he talking about? Hey, he starts talking about his hair. Because he says,
I'm very pro-Israel. He says.
And I'm pro-Israel. But then he'll spend 10 minutes talking about his hair because his hair was in the wind. And so there's this obsession with self. Absolute obsession. And usually, you know what I would say is Donald Trump, he does not look like a happy man. Right. I
mean, you don't think so?
I think he's a misery man. I think he is a misery. Think about it. Think about it. Whenever... He's got skin as thin as rice paper. That's not pleasant. It's not pleasant to feel people's insults, to have to come after every insult, to just look at his demeanor. He doesn't smile very much. He doesn't look very happy. And he's constantly fighting. It's not fun. It's not fun constantly griping and fighting and swearing and, you know. And by the way, there's a lovely, you can now, AI can actually diagnose depression from your statements on Facebook. It's quite incredible.
Really?
Yeah. And the one thing, it's actually quite it's quite fascinating, this, is how many first person pronouns you use. So people who, there's a lot of I, me, lots of those is an indicator of depression. Now let me just before we all go and diagnose our friends on Facebook, please, you know, there's more to it than that, but that is the hallmark.
That's interesting.
Think about Donald Trump. It's always I, me. I promise you, this man is not having much fun.
That's a very, you see, this is what I love hearing from people like you. You've got this sort of observational skill. That's interesting. That's really insightful.
I think we look at people who are very powerful and we possibly a little bit envious, or we feel like they must, you know, be happy because look, they've got all this money and they've got all this power. We know anyway from the science of happiness. Happiness is really not correlated to wealth. It isn't.
No. You know? No. A lot of people imagine their world would be better if they were rich and powerful or famous or good looking. It's not the case. You would have the same personality, and your personality is what's going to be your biggest factor in determining your happiness.
Totally. And I mean, you can give people a clear idea why this is. So, you know, I always say to people, how excited are you about your Christmas presents that you got last December? You know, most people are like, I can't remember those Christmas presents, right? So now, because here, I'll give you a way to boost your happiness more than winning the lottery. And this is a solid piece of research on this. So, firstly, if you just won the lottery right now, I couldn't compete with that happiness because you're going to be really excited. Here's the problem. 6 months to a year later, your happiness goes back to what we call the baseline level of happiness, the happiness you were at before you won the lottery. And this is because of a fascinating concept called habituation, which is where we become desensitized to the things that we have. So like your Christmas presents, you're really excited for a while, then you start to forget about them. Now think you've got everything. You've got all the things you could, material things. You get used to having those material
things.
And you
need to keep upping the ante. It's like a drug addict.
Correct.
Addict, right?
And there's no upping because you've basically got everything now, right? Hmm. So interesting. What makes
then
us
you need to run for president.
Then you have to run for president. Exactly. And you're still not happy. And then you're more miserable.
You win the election, you get your high, but then you've got to win the next election.
Exactly. And you can't win everything, you know, because you don't win everything. I mean, the best things in life aren't things. They're experiences. So experiences do amplify well-being, but not things, you know, which is probably...
That's interesting, because I see people. There's this dude I spoke about on the plane with me the other day. He had this Louis Vuitton bag, which is a ridiculous little Louis Vuitton bag. You couldn't fit anything in it. And he's a man, and he's carrying around this, like, a vanity case. Mm. But it's important for him, because obviously it's a symbol of his success, right? But that's not going to make him happy.
No, and in fact, there's even a correlation between for people who are very materialistic, who, you know, love labels, who have all that stuff, and again, low emotional well-being. So you're looking at a kind of compensation. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I know that, you know, we like, there's certain things it's nice to have things, and
sure.
I'm not saying we can't get some pleasure out of them, but it's the amount of emphasis that you put on that. I mean, obviously, I find labels bizarre. Like, Louis Vuitton, I mean, you know, God bless them. They're entrepreneurs trying to make a buck like everyone else.
So whoever made that bag, whoever designed that particular bag, was really just raising the middle finger to everyone and saying, if you're stupid enough to buy this, we're going to give it to you at a huge price.
That's what I meant. See? Yeah. He says it like it is.
Did you really underline, because you wrote in my book. No, you did. Dear G, blah, 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 always a privilege to be on air with you. Warmest regards, Justin. Very nice of you. And then I saw, you didn't write anything. You didn't put in, and then what page do I open it on? And you've underlined. Did you underline this for me?
That's so funny. So firstly, I thought you'd never get there because I never thought you'd, you know, read the book. But I actually never wrote it. I walked in and saw Alan Ford, who I've not seen for many years. Alan Ford.
I'm sorry about that.
Picks up. Alan picks up the book, opens it. And by the way, I just want to say, and I'm going to give myself a compliment.
Go on, you're allowed to.
So my mark of a good book, and try this. I want everybody to try this. This is the mark of a good book. Open it to any page. But like people use their Bible. Like Christians will go, I'll open my Bible to any page and it'll be something that'll tell me
It's like that's like reading a horoscope.
So I would say pick up any book. Read whatever line is there. And by the way, fiction or nonfiction.
All right.
If it's good, that line, the book is 90% is going to be a great book. If it's not good, 90% is not going to be a great book. Try it.
Go back to how this is underlined.
So now I'm giving myself a compliment. So he opened the book to that page, and he goes, oh, look at this. Fuck, that's really true. You know, I don't know if he actually said that. I might be putting words in his mouth. But he said, that's really powerful. You know, the idea that it's actually a point on purpose, because for me, pitching, it's not just about selling and trying to, you know, get a deal. It's actually about pitching your difference, pitching your purpose. So I want people to understand what their purpose is. And there's a whole process to do that. And one of the questions that I give people, a quick, easy win on figuring out your purpose, living with purpose, pitching with purpose, is how are people going to be better off because of me?
Mm-hmm.
And the lovely Alan Ford pointed out that it was specifically for Gareth, right? So I see he's giving me hand signals.
Yeah, how are these people going to be better off because of me?
Which is a way, because people generally pitch and sell thinking about themselves. How am I going to get the deal? How am I going to win? How am I going to get my commission? And that's completely the wrong way to do it, because who do you want to buy from? Somebody who's all about themselves, or somebody who really wants to make a difference for you? If you go in with like, you know, how am I going to make a difference to you? You know, and I think Alan's getting to the point that, you know, you, Gareth, make a... I can't believe I'm giving you so many compliments. It's actually, I'm starting to actually sicken myself.
Okay, let me ask you about this, because I don't want to talk about that anymore. I'm sorry you even brought it up. let's talk about stress, because you talk about stress and then you talk about performance, and there's this interesting relationship between stress and performance that you've also done a bit of research around. People often think that you need to stress yourself out to the limit, that you need to make yourself crazy, that you need to work your fingers to the bone in order to have the best performance. That's not true.
No.
Because the stress doesn't make you perform well.
No. So there's a beautiful there's the curve in the book. It's called the Yerkes-Dodson stress performance bell curve. Let me see if I can describe it without a visual to your listeners. Right. But basically, if you think of a bell curve, and on the x-axis you've got performance.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think of performance. We're allowed to be a little risque.
Go
here. Think about an erection. That's
right.
Performance, right?
Okay.
That's your x-axis. And then your, and in fact, by the way, this applies to sex as well.
Okay.
And then think of your y-axis is stress. Now, stress is arousal. And I don't just mean sexual arousal. Stress is arousal, energy. It's about output, right? Now, Now, you need, if you're asleep, you can't perform at all, right?
Sure.
If you're dead, no you stress. Can't believe it. No stress, and you're dead, you're gone. Stress is not the baddie, by the way. Very important to understand. Stress is not the baddie.
Okay.
In fact, there's what we call eustress and distress. Eustress is good stress. It's right now I'm feeling pretty stressed, but in a good stress. Like I'm excited, we're having a great conversation, my energy's flowing, it's beautiful. I love this state. I mean, I'm really having a lot of fun, right? And I am stressed. It's a good eustress. Now, if I suddenly start, and often it actually comes with the internal voice of like, oh, I'm not good enough, or you know, does you know, am I getting this right on the show, or are the you know listeners going to think I'm you know? When you start second guessing, then your stress level, and by the way, stress is adrenaline, dopamine, so it's biochemical. Now, when that arousal level goes up, 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 now there's a midpoint. If you think of a bell, the midpoint is great, and then more stress past that point, and performance goes down. And again,
that's
right?
Distress.
That's distress, right? And that's when you've actually got so very nice little distinction, and it's pretty blunt. There's not a lot of nuance in this, but it's helpful. You've got a lower brain and a higher brain. Lower brain is reptilian brain, fight or flight, stress response, and then higher brain is prefrontal cortex, which is creativity, thoughtfulness, reflection. Now, when you're in a very high stress state, high adrenaline, you've got massive activation of reptilian brain. Great if you're running or fighting a lion, right? So for your caveman ancestors, you actually wanted to be in a very high stress state to survive. But for you and I, for most of the cognitive tasks that we do, we don't want massive levels of stress. So our optimum stress level is lower, is much lower than that. It's not totally out. It's, mm-hmm. It's in the middle of the bell curve. Exactly.
Okay, so you want to be fully hard, and you want to be fully aroused.
Yeah, and we joke, but honestly, a lot of sexual dysfunction is because of too much stress, because, you know, you're self-conscious, or you feel you're not performing. We call it performance anxiety. You know, you think, oh, you know, does she, you know, like me? Does she? All of that interferes and actually builds stress. So, in fact, it does apply to sexual performance as much as it applies to any other.
The other thing that you talk about, and this really is a useful book, not just for salespeople, but for, as you say, people who are trying to make an impact. And let's say you have a powerful story that helps you enormously, because people respond to stories. And these days in advertising and creative businesses and professions and output of any kind, people are obsessed with this idea of story. But what do you mean by story when you talk about it in your book?
So story is something I'm very passionate about. You know, my background was not just psychology, but I was in theater, I was in film. So I have a strong personal affinity to storytelling. And then as I became a corporate speaker and trainer, I started to see that story could be a very powerful tool to be used within organizations in different ways. So for learning and development, you know, if you think about it, what's the best-selling book of all time? It's the Bible. What is the Bible? The Bible is a series of stories. So story. Stories are a great way to learn. And what university did is it kind of told us that stories, case studies, examples, they were, no, we had to be abstract. We needed to get abstract principles. The problem is the neuroscience shows us that the brain is much more likely to remember and act on powerful stories rather than on abstract facts. So in terms of persuasion, you want to share real life examples.
Is this why people in the news these days are constantly telling us stories about people who suffered and went through shit, and then they suddenly made it?
Yes, and I know you're going to love this, and I can't believe I'm shooting myself in the foot. But okay. but look, stories are very powerful for influence, very powerful. But what you're going to enjoy, and I don't know if you're familiar with Daniel Kahneman. Kahneman
Thinking
is
fast and slow.
Beautiful. So Kahneman's Nobel Prize winning economist, who's actually a psychologist, done a lot of work in behavioral economics. So Kahneman. It's got this brilliant concept, which is not in the book. I can only bring this up on your show because I know how delighted you'll be by this. It's called the narrative fallacy. Mm-hmm. And you've just pointed to an example of what he'd call the narrative fallacy. And the narrative fallacy is that you hear a story. Think about a story about the Google guys, Larry Brin and
Sergey Brin and Larry Page.
Page. And we go, oh, look at these guys. You know, they started from nothing, and then they came, and they were offered $1 million for Google. They were, by the way, they weren't offered it. They asked for $1 million, and they would have sold it for $1 million. 100% would have sold it for $1 million, but couldn't find anyone to give them $1 million. $100. So they were forced to do it. You know, it's a beautiful story, yada, yada, yada. And kind of, you know, rags to riches, boom, boom. You can do it too. Kahneman calls that the narrative fallacy. The idea that you can do it too. So he's saying, you ignoring the fact that there are circumstances, particular circumstances that conspired to this. And when you read that, one gets, he would argue, a false sense that, oh, if they...
Anything is possible.
Correct.
This is Oprah's, if I can believe it, I can achieve it.
Exactly.
Exactly. All of that stuff. And it leads people to tremendous unhappiness.
Absolutely, Kath. And it's interesting, we're coming full circle because we started talking about belief is important. If you don't believe you can, you won't even try. What I say is belief is necessary but not sufficient. If you don't believe it, you're not even trying. But belief's not enough. So this is Napoleon Hill, who wrote a book that called Think and Grow Rich. And Napoleon Hill was actually quite an unsavory character. A lot of people don't realize this. It's still a book that is still widely regarded. It's a bit like The Secrets of its day.
Was he just a horrible person?
He was a horrible person, but there was like, oh my gosh, there was some really dodgy stuff.
What, like a racist, like an anti-Semite?
No, not so much. No, come on, let's tear him down!
What kind of a guy was this?
But Napoleon Hill said, whatever the mind can conceive and believe, it can achieve. And that's become this rallying cry for the personal development. Okay. Whatever the mind can conceive and believe. And I kind of want to say, well, to your point, you know what? A lot of people believe stuff out there. They don't believe they're going to get cancer. They don't believe that they're going to get fired. They don't believe they're going to get divorced. Nobody gets married believing they're going to get divorced. And people do. So you can't tell me that belief is enough. You know, you can't. That clearly it's not enough.
Evidence is not in your favor.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, but without belief. Now, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Without belief. You're not even
out
begin.
Of the starting blocks.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
So this Daniel Kahneman thing.
So the Daniel Kahneman on story is it? Story is very powerful because we go. The various reasons. Stories are a big driver of persuasion because we go. We hear a story, and because of the mirror neural network, it's this fascinating part of the brain we've discovered where you actually you know that feeling when you're watching a film or reading a book and you become the hero.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh man, you actually feel, I mean, this is what I love about stories, right? You feel like, you know, the greatest gift of a story is that you get to live these lives that you didn't have to build for yourself. You know, you just get to live these lives, right? I mean, I guess at worst, it's just an escape from your own life, but it's best, you know, you can actually learn lessons from those lives, you know? So that stories are wonderful. I call them a virtual reality machine. You know, you actually live through these lives. Now, that's the best of it. But so you live the life and go, wow, if they can do it, maybe so can I. But that's what Kahneman contends. He goes, well, there's a whole lot more going on than what you can.
What you can have is an approximation of that story in some way, shape, or form. And you may believe, and it may give you the fuel to be able to live out your own story, but it's going to go in a different direction.
Yeah.
You can't match that wave. You can't match that curve.
You can be inspired
vibration.
By it, and you can learn a few lessons, but know that your life is your life, and it's going to have to be lived.
And people are very uncomfortable. You brought up failure earlier and the way we compliment children. A lot of people are very unhappy and uncomfortable with failure. They're not sure how to deal with it. They consider it a judgment on their entire existence. It's like some people will take a joke, a comment, and it will become an obsession for them to the point where it can affect the outcome of their lives. Some people have serious trouble with what other people say about them. They're not sure how to deal with the world. They're very fragile.
Yeah. Look, we are one of the reasons we're very rejection sensitive, and one of the keys to a winning pitch.
Well, that's evolutionary biology, right?
Correct.
That's because if we get thrown out of the tribe, if we get rejected from the tribe, we're fucked.
You'll die. So we actually see or feel rejection as an existential threat. Because our caveman ancestors, it was.
You're out of the tribe, you're going to die.
Exactly. So one of the keys in pitching is optimism. It takes on average 7 exposures to a new product, service, or person before people will feel comfortable enough to buy.
I know people who still won't go online to buy things. I say to them, are you crazy?
Right. So they're not, because the key thing is not to take it personally and to realize that rejection is not an existential threat, and it's not, you're not even getting rejected I mean, maybe they don't like you, seven but maybe times, they're just not comfortable.
So no. If you get seven no's, there's a yes coming.
Correct, correct. So we have to learn to embrace failure. We've got to learn to fail forward. And, you know, there's an old saying in Silicon Valley, fail fast, fail often. Because actually failure, Bill Gates, you know, Bill Gates is obsessed with failure, which I find fascinating. The world's second richest man, obsessed with failure. He's real beautiful things like success, he says, is a lousy teacher. It seduces smart people into thinking they can't lose. Yeah. The biggest impediment to progress, says Bill Gates, is success, because it makes you complacent. Listen, Gareth, you could still be on 5 FM.
Ugh.
You know, you could be there, right? You were winning. That was success. You were going, hey, why mess with a good thing? Instead, you decided to subject yourself to massive risk. I mean, you were doing something here that nobody had done before. I promise you, I was one of the people going, really? Dude, I get it. I know we're going there.
I know. I got your number. I remember. No, I think a lot of people are stuck in what they consider to be maximal success, too. And maybe they have the potential for more. This is what I'm interested in with you, is you talk about human potential. And I'm sorry to keep going back to this. But how do you know? Like, how can you tell that there's someone with potential? There are a lot of people, they don't have potential. I've met loads of people, very nice people, but no potential. How do you see it?
No, look, I mean, I would have to, vigorously disagree with that.
All right.
Because even just logically, I think your statement has a logical flaw. I mean,
okay. Potential
is the ability to do something more than you're currently doing.
Uh-huh.
Now, even if you are a, intelligence, you know, yeah, you've still got. There's still the possibility of more. Just logically, there's that possibility.
In other words, there isn't the cup can't be. It doesn't have a finite volume.
No, it doesn't. Donald Trump has the potential to be kind.
Wow,
he does.
Wouldn't that be something?
But he really does. And by the way, I've seen he has on the odd occasion made a kind-ish statement where you kind of, you know, I mean, we've all got the potential to be other than what we are. There's no doubt about
that.
You know, give me all of the potential to become astronauts and fly to the moon.
That was a stupid thing for me to say then.
Well, I'm glad. And that was one thing I'll give you, self-awareness.
stupid point of view. I take it all back. I've learned.
I think what you might be getting at, which is something that I've often struggled, is that, and you pointed out earlier, and I think it's one of the excesses of the self-help movement, this idea that you can be a billionaire. You know, you can fly to the moon. You can. Now, of course, I don't think anybody can say anyone can't, because there's a lot of people who've said that certain people, you know, one of my favorite examples of this, you know, 1903, the New York Times, most credible publication on the planet, reports there's a couple of brothers trying to fly
Wilbur and Orville.
I don't think they were talking about them. They're saying there were people trying to fly a heavier-than-air machine. And the New York Times, most credible publication, says, look, this is... Like, if it's ever going to happen, it's going to take, quote, thousands of mechanics working for up to 10 million years. Like, if it's going to happen, right? Months later, two brothers, unfunded, uneducated, unknown, fly the world's first airplane. So whenever I think of, like, you can't, or that just seems outlandish, I go, who am I to say? So... I think that's a good starting point for this. But can every person on this planet be a billionaire? Potentially, yes. Is everyone going to? No. And
so what do you call that thing that brings down the potential to reality? What do you call that thing? Because we know we call that other part belief, or we call it potential. But what do we call that thing that drags it down?
Well,
what do we call that coefficient, that variable that makes it... less possible.
My personal development friends are not going to like me saying this. There are many factors. There is belief. There's ability. There's hard work. Motivation, we could talk about, is critical. Mm-hmm. Number one factor, self-motivation. Actually more important than talent, intelligence. So another discussion. The one part in the personal development field people don't want to talk about is, you know, to use a colloquial term, luck. You know, circumstances.
Ah.
I mean, Gareth, you know, you and I, you know, we're both fortunate to have, and I use the word fortunate. You know, life is not fair. No. Why are you sitting there behind us in this, you know, you have all this kudos, you have this, yes, you have a lot of ability, you work extremely hard, but you didn't, you know, I mean, unless you're taking some sort of spiritual view here, you didn't choose your life, you didn't choose to be born,
no.
You didn't choose what schools you went to, what,
didn't even choose
you know,
my name.
You didn't choose your name, right? So all of those things conspired to bring you to this point in your life.
Yeah.
And you didn't.
No,
you
thanks a lot. I didn't choose this face.
No,
I should look a whole lot better.
No. Well, you know, there's
absolutely
things you can do about that.
So that thing is luck.
That thing is luck. And you know, Gareth, I mean, my next project. I'm actually doing my doctorate at the moment, which I'm really excited about. And I'm tracking my professional development. It's with Middlesex. It's called a DProf professional doctorate, where I look back critically. This is the whole thing. Critically, skeptically, at my field, the personal development field, which I've been. I'm obviously a great fan of, but I'm also have some major concerns about. And I'm now getting to the point where my work is shifting to, hey, you can do anything. Go out there, make it happen. And you said it earlier, that can actually produce a lot of unhappiness and, you know, disappointments.
Because happiness is where expectations don't meet reality.
Exactly.
Happiness is where expectations do meet reality. Unhappiness.
Yeah.
So, all right. So in other words, you're about to become the enemy of your own people.
Well. So here's the thing.
That's your doctorate.
Beautifully,
your doctorate's about to put you at odds with so many of your former colleagues.
Beautifully put. But in fact, I thought so. And then, as I've been putting this together, I'm realizing that it's not a dichotomy. It is, there's an integration. And what I'm planning to do is actually integrate. So very briefly, what do we talk about? And if you and I have achieved anything in life, it's because we took action. We made stuff happen. Yeah? I mean, we went out. There are a lot of people there who talk. This is a big thing. A lot of people know. Not a lot of people do. And I think the best of the personal development field is, you know, figure out what you want, put a plan together, get off your ass, and go make it happen. And then fall down and fail. Learn the lesson, get up, you know.
Do it again.
Do it again. Try again. Fall down 8 times, get up 9, as the Buddhists like to say. You know, that there's a beauty. I love that. And for me, this is one of the, I love being a human being on planet Earth because it's fun. And you get to do stuff.
I am so on your side. The miracle isn't what will happen to us after we die or what happened before.
Oh, yeah.
The miracle is like now.
Oh, totally, man. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said.
What are the, in the infinite possibilities of this universe, that Justin Cohen should be sitting here. What are the chances?
Oh,
it's phenomenal.
My goodness. It is, and it's beautiful. You know, so mysterious. And I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, one life is miracle enough. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It is a miracle.
Correct.
It is just
people want more.
Incredible.
Greedy. What a greedy creature you are. You exist. You're organic.
Exactly.
You're viable.
Exactly.
Stop being so selfish that you can only think of what else you could have.
Yeah.
Stop it. How dare you? How dare you talk about potential? Be grateful for what you've got.
For what you have. What?
Okay. I love it. I mean, we could talk all day, and we probably will. So this book is called Pitch to Win. If you liked what Justin was saying just now, you need to read this because it'll help you. There's some actual practical stuff. I saw voice exercises. Mm-hmm. So breathing. Mm. Ways you must change your facial expressions if you want to pitch properly to people. Mm-hmm. This is very, very handy.
It's practical.
Yes. It's not practical. This is not psychobabble. This is seriously useful, practical information. I think it's going to be a massive success. I mean, if this isn't, then what do you know about pitching?
Yeah, that's well. I will say that I continue to lose pitches because you don't win every pitch.
It's also going to be comfortable with failure.
Absolutely. Yes. But it is number two.
Which to bring us back. Hang on, before you start boasting about where you are on the sales charts. Yeah. The other thing that to bring us back to the beginning of this discussion, Donald has to get comfortable with losing. I don't think he is. I don't think he knows much about that.
We have to get comfortable with Donald winning.
Some people do. No, so that's absolutely right. That's the corollary.
Yeah.
To every theory, there's a corollary theory. Yeah. So now, you're number two on what list?
Exclusive Books Business Books.
Good
exclusive
Lord.
Exclusive Books Business
Already?
Books.
How long's the book been out?
It's a few months.
How come I'm only talking to you about it now?
Well, Mr. Clare is
very.
Here.
This is irresponsible PR work. Totally irresponsible.
I got to say that.
It's not like you didn't know how to get hold of me.
No, that is true.
You've been sitting in your backside. Where's your potential? Get out of here.
I'm a slow starter. Right. I'll get there eventually.
Justin Cohen, everybody. How to present, persuade, and close the deal. It's called Pitch to Win, the internationally acclaimed six-step formula, and you can get it at exclusive books, but you can also order it online. You know how to do this. It's very, very easy. Improve your life. Start living to your true potential. Stop being a wastrel. layabout. Shiftless. Stop.
Man, it's so much fun, Gary. So much. I hope you'll have me back. I really enjoyed it.
I like talking to you.
They're good fun.
Very nice. Thank you. CliffCentral.com.